Ontario, such initiatives are sometimes life-saving for the poor and constitute a message of unity among Syrians. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Top NGOs gathered in the United States for a peace summit with the stated goal of fighting the war machine. The forum sought to empower and organize activists to stop U.S.-backed wars in Palestine, Yemen, Ukraine, and elsewhere, but they know that cultural resistance to peace appears deep.
We in the U.S. are so ingrained that domination of the world is our right. And, you know, being a nation founded on genocide, founded on slavery and those types of things, domination is just kind of in the air, and it seems normal, but it's really not normal.
Last month marked the 20th anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. The war is widely considered a disaster, even within the United States, and yet Washington's foreign policy remains just as belligerent.
In 2002, polls showed that 67% of Americans disapproved of taking military action against Iraq. But then-Senator Joe Biden led the Democratic Party's bipartisan effort to invade. As president, Biden has stifled peace efforts, sent massive amounts of arms, and created a new quagmire, this time in Ukraine.
Well, we don't really have democracy. We have a state that calls itself a democracy. Biden just had a democracy summit, but we have a rigged system. We're allowed to vote, but that process is in itself corrupt. It gives the impression that we have input when we do not. The people don't have representation in this country. Defense contractors do, real estate developers do, big pharma does, but the people do not.
However, we're a long way from 2002. Many speakers noted the newfound inability of Washington to act unilaterally, which many around the world view as a positive.
And now you have other countries around the world. You have China, Russia, Iran, India. We have these emerging countries that represent regional threats, only because these countries now have the ability to chart their own paths of independent development, and that is very concerning to the United States and its goals of, you know, world hegemony.
The United States has existed for 246 years and been at war for 228 of them. They have nearly 800 military bases stationed in over 40% of the world's nations. Washington's war machine is strong, but activists say the average American's desire for peace is far stronger. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
A British public school in London has sparked controversy amid furious parent complaints that their children are being prevented from performing obligatory Islamic prayers during school hours. Michaela Community School in Wembley have been accused of blatant Islamophobia after students allegedly informed parents of several incidents which saw teachers interrupting praying pupils in an apparent attempt to ban Muslim worship. News first broke of the scandal after a petition was launched demanding that the school provide a prayer space for students. The petition lists examples of what allegedly took place.
On Thursday, the 23rd of March, students at Michaela were performing their obligatory prayers at the schoolyard. The pupils were praying on their prayer mats, and the teacher approaches the students and tells them to stop praying. She then says, "You need to leave your Islamic cultures alone. This is the West." She then tells them that they're not allowed a prayer mat at this school, and she says if she sees this again, she will give them a detention. One of the students praying was then excluded.
The story is concerning enough on its own, but what makes matters worse is that it's far from the only example of a UK school apparently showing signs that it may have a problem with its religious Muslim students. Over the past 24 months, multiple other examples have popped up across the country with schools facing similar accusations.
In December 2021, Manchester's Oldham Academy School apologised after students felt forced to pray outside in the cold. In January 2022, Park High School in Stanmore went viral over footage allegedly showing a teacher attempting to halt Juma prayers. While this year has also seen two Birmingham-based schools embroiled in a row over LGBT propaganda lessons, seemingly targeting Muslim students in an attempt to change their understanding of Islam's position on same-gender relationships.
Don't remain silent. Don't suffer in silence. So in specific cases like these, school kids need to record these incidents and write down witness statements ASAP and then get parents and police involved. Because when the shoe is on the other foot and a Muslim child is accused of extremism, police are called in against you. Equality cuts both ways. And the bigger picture, it needs to involve a sustained effort by the Muslim community to abnormalize Islamophobia in media and politics. So irrelevant politicians and journalists who have nothing useful to say to society stop benefiting from dividing us.
Mikaya Community School has so far not responded to the story. But with so many similar incidents of alleged Islamophobia occurring in UK schools, the toxic atmosphere is likely part of a much bigger problem. Robert Carter, London.
A new report by the UNHCR has revealed that women's businesses in Afghanistan are severely affected by the Taliban's increasing restrictions. The report shows a sharp decline of women's participation in the labor market from 28% to 7%, and the consequent impact on the Afghan economy, that is witnessing a 30 to 35% drop in GDP in the past 2 years.
We Afghan women can help Afghanistan economy and people's livelihood grow. Afghanistan is a rich country, especially when it comes to agricultural minerals and handicraft. Afghan women can play a vital role in developing these sectors and contributing to national incomes. However, they need more opportunities and support to lead their business and pursue their passions. This means they need work license, freedom of movement, and access to local and global market.
Here in the women's market in Kabul, we spoke with some business women who told us their stories of hardship and resilience amid the Taliban's limitations. They say they're losing customers and opportunities which are meant to develop their businesses. Some of them have experienced a significant drop in their income, while others fear they may have to shut down their businesses soon.
Unfortunately, the Taliban's restrictions on women have wiped out educational and business opportunities. Women can't work in such a limited environment. Here in the women's market, we are receiving fewer customers, contractors, and funds than ever before. My fellow entrepreneurs are desperate, with some aiming to close their shops and end activities.
Many NGOs have stopped working with business women after the Taliban banned NGOs' female workers. These NGOs used to help us with getting work permits, finding contractors, and supplying some essentials. But all these supports are gone. As a result, we are operating at a loss since we have to pay for farmers' wages and production costs without any income.
Emphasizing the need for women's economic empowerment, UNHCR has called on the Taliban to respect and safeguard the rights to work and education for women. The agency has also appealed to the international community to sustain its support for humanitarian and development initiatives that benefit women and girls in Afghanistan. The plight of Afghan business women is just one example of how Afghan women are impacted by the Taliban restrictions. Now it's a matter of time that whether the de facto authorities will change their policies against women. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The strike group of the USS Nimitz aircraft carrier conducted military exercises off the Korean Peninsula this week. This follows 11 days of the largest land-based drills involving South Korea and the U.S. in almost 5 years. The U.S. has increased joint drills with South Korea in the past year, particularly those involving nuclear-capable weapons, so-called strategic assets.
The United States has deployable strategic assets at the ready on every day. And we can continue to deploy those assets, and we will. Again, we really want to underpin the international security and the global commons so we can all prosper. And I think that's our message.
North Korea protested the drills test-firing ballistic and cruise missiles as Pyongyang views such exercises as a rehearsal for invasion. The Nimitz drills were followed up with a massive joint U.S.-South Korea amphibious landing exercise Wednesday. Activists argue such drills carry risks.
The more South Korea-U.S. military exercises are conducted, the larger the scale, the stronger the North is protesting and testing more missiles. If the South Korea-U.S. military exercises expand, the confrontation will intensify, and I think increase this vicious cycle of confrontation.
For President Yoon Suk-yeol, the drills show how he's succeeded in strengthening the U.S.-South Korea alliance.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol earlier this month re-emphasized his hardline position with North Korea, saying that Pyongyang would pay a price for its recent missile launches, what he calls provocations. President Yoon also said North Korea would not receive a penny in aid from the South as long as it continued its nuclear weapons development.
The confrontation on the Korean Peninsula may heat up further with even larger exercises planned to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the U.S.-South Korea alliance in June. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A massive march has been held along the fence separating the Gaza Strip from the occupied territories to commemorate the 47th anniversary of the Land Day. People from all walks of life took to the streets of the besieged Gaza Strip to stress their right to return to their land.
We are here today to commemorate the Land Day to stress on our Palestinian identity and our entitlement to the land. We say to the Israeli occupation, you have no place in Palestine. Leave it so the world can eventually enjoy peace and freedom.
Land Day marks the events of March the 30th, 1976, where six Palestinians were killed by Israeli forces during peaceful protests against the Tel Aviv regime's decision to seize tracts of Palestinian-owned lands. Palestinians call on the international community and the Arab countries to support the Palestinian people in their quest for liberation.
We are addressing all the international community, the Arabs, the Muslims in the world, to stand up, to stand up with us, to support us, to support also our resistance to return to my home. We are refugees. We are going to return sooner or later.
The National and Islamic Action factions emphasized the unity of the Palestinian people. They also reaffirmed the Palestinians' right to resist, stressing that resistance is the sole way to restore the stolen Palestinian land.
Today we assert on the Palestinians' adherence to their lands and to the Al-Quds, the eternal capital of Palestine, and we affirm on the resistance as the most appropriate choice to free Palestine.
The Thursday peaceful demonstration turned violent when the Israeli forces shot and injured a Palestinian with live ammunition. Two others were injured when they were hit by tear gas canisters used by the regime's troops to disperse the protesters. This reminds us of what happened in the Great March of Return rallies, which began in 2018 and lasted for 86 weeks. During the protests, more than 300 Palestinians were killed by the Israeli troops, and thousands more sustained injuries, including so serious wounds that led to the loss of limbs.
I was wounded with Israeli live ammunition in the Great March of Return, and today, despite my injury in my leg that might get amputated, I am here today to commemorate the Land Day, stress on our steadfastness despite the Israeli atrocities.
The Israeli regime seizes the Palestinian own land and demolishes Palestinians' homes in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds in order to construct new illegal settlements.
These annual demonstrations serve as an act of collective resistance to the Israeli occupation as Palestinian demonstrators voice their anger at the regime's crimes and land grab policies and reiterate their entitlement and right of return to their own land. Al-Asif, Gaza.
Russia and Iran are in the final stage of finalizing a draft agreement on comprehensive partnership between the countries.
I am very grateful that the draft of comprehensive agreement on strategic partnership between our countries has been reviewed and finalized in Russia. We are now reviewing it again as well. I very much hope that within the next month, the legal departments of the foreign ministries of our two countries will finalize this draft.
The document is of strategic importance of solid, balanced new realities of bilateral cooperation between Moscow and Tehran. The treaty outlines the main guidelines for further building of the entire complex of Russian-Iranian relations for the coming decades. Among them is that Iran and Russia both agree that the JCPOA has no alternatives and needs to be implemented as soon as possible.
We talked about the situation around the JCPOA on the Iranian nuclear program. We have a common understanding that there is no alternative to this international agreement, which was written down in the unanimously adopted UN Security Council Resolution 2231. We are in favor of the early resumption of the full implementation of this resolution and oppose actions that prevent this.
Lavrov said that the U.S. needs to lift sanctions against Iran and return to its obligations under JCPOA. The minister added that the West also seeks to neutralize China along with Russia.
Therefore, Russia, Iran, China, and many other countries will categorically oppose attempts to establish Western hegemony forever and ever, as Washington and its henchmen are trying to do.
Lavrov noted that Russia respects Iran's interests in a peaceful settlement of the Ukrainian conflict. Amir Abdullahian, for his part, pointed out that Western supplies of various weapons to Kyiv complicate the Ukraine conflict, which he said should only be settled via political means. Meanwhile, Russian-Iranian cooperation in the military technical sphere is carried out in accordance with Russia's international obligations. The parties have found an approach in all areas when it is possible to concentrate on coinciding interests and systematically build up economic cooperation as well.
Russia has become the largest investor in Iran over the past fiscal year. Russia accounted for two-thirds of the total foreign direct investments in the Islamic Republic. The volume of Moscow's investments in Iran has reached $2.76 billion. Marina Kartonova, Moscow.
In the limelight.
The results of a latest research show that majority of the people in UK are dissatisfied with the performance of the health system in this country. The recent findings of reputable polling institutes show two-thirds of the British people believe the level of medical services in this country is dire, and 80% say the situation has worsened over the past 5 years after Brexit. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Please stay with us to hear more about the story. The Guardian Daily writes, a new survey has found more than half of ambulance workers have seen a patient die because of a delay in reaching them after a 999 call or overcrowding in accident and emergency departments. The findings from a survey of frontline paramedics and other ambulance staff are another stark illustration of the patient safety risks created by the crisis in NHS urgent and emergency care. Rachel Harrison, the National Secretary of the GMB Union, which sought the views of more than 1,200 members working in NHS ambulance services in England and Wales, said, "These findings are utterly terrifying." It asked them if they had ever witnessed a death that had occurred because of a delay involving an ambulance or other parts of the care system. Just over half, that is 53%, said they had done so, and another 30% were aware of it happening with a colleague. Three quarters, 76% of those surveyed said delays had an impact on patient care every day. And over half, 52%, said they had spent an entire shift waiting outside an A&E to hand the patient over to hospital staff. We'll be right back. The findings are disclosed in a Channel 4 Dispatches documentary being shown on Thursday, March 2nd, about how long delays in ambulance crews handing over patients to A&E staff and thus being unable to respond quickly to 999 calls are affecting both patients and the staff. The program is based on footage secretly shot over 3 months by Daniel Waterhouse, an emergency medical technician with the East of England Ambulance Service, who has since resigned. Dr. Adrian Boyle, the president of the Royal College of Emergency Medicine, told the program, "The delay and dilation of care that we see is just unconscionable." Dr. Sanjeev Nayak, a leading stroke doctor, told Dispatches, "We have seen patients this winter who have been harmed because of ambulance delays," adding, "If they're late, we cannot treat them. There is very little we as doctors can do. A couple of hours delay means the patient can die or suffer disability." Dr. Sonia Narayan, a consultant cardiologist and the associate medical director of the British Heart Foundation, said, "When a patient has had a heart attack, it is vital that an ambulance gets to them as soon as possible because minutes can be the difference between the life and death." Meanwhile, the Reddit.com reports, according to analysis of NHS figures by emergency care doctors, one patient is dying every 23 minutes in England after they endured a long delay in an E&A unit. In all, according to the Royal College of Emergency Medicine, RCEM, 23,003 people died during 2022 after spending at least 12 hours in an A&E waiting for care or to be admitted to a bed. That equates to roughly one every 23 minutes, 63 every day, 442 a week, or 1,917 each month. The college said its findings, while shocking, were also unsurprising and reflected the fact that emergency departments are often overwhelmed and unable to find patients a bed in the hospital. Daisy Cooper, the Liberal Democrats' health spokesperson, said patients are now dying in their droves due to successive Conservative governments neglecting the NHS, and added that the lives lost due to A&E snarl-ups constituted a natural disaster. It has been warning since last September that up to 500 deaths have been occurring every week in A&Es in England because so many patients have spent so long there, a claim the NHS denies. The RCEM previously based its claim on Office for National Statistics figures showing that it was recording 500 excess deaths a week that it could not explain. However, the college's new research uses different data, this time showing the number of people, 1,656,206 in total, who spent at least 12 hours in an emergency department after arrival last year. It obtained that from NHS England using Freedom of Information laws. It then analyzed those figures alongside existing evidence by a group of A&E doctors published in a medical journal last year, using a measure known as the standard mortality ratio. They concluded that one extra patient dies for every 72 who spend between 8 and 12 hours in A&E. Dr. Adrian Boyle, RCEM's president, said long waiting times are associated with serious patient harm and patient death, adding, "The scale shown here is deeply distressing." Boyle said that NHS England practice of only publishing data on the number of patients who end up spending 12 hours in A&E after doctors have decided to admit them was misleading and disguised the full scale of long waits that are now endemic across the health service. We'll be right back. Furthermore, the Anadolu Agency writes information shared by the National Health Service, NHS, has revealed long hours of admission periods at emergency departments of British hospitals have caused 23,000 excess deaths in 2022. The health workers' unions have long been criticizing the way the issues surrounding NHS are being handled by the government, saying that there is a huge workload on the staff, whom are unhappy with the working conditions and financial status of their jobs. The government acknowledges staff shortages, but do not necessarily agree that excess death numbers are definitively accurate. The Royal College of Emergency Medicine has reportedly sent Freedom of Information request to the NHS for its latest data on accident and emergency waiting times, discovering more than 1.6 million patients had to wait longer than 12 hours in the department from the moment they walked in until the time they left. The requested information was being sought to find out the number of people who waited more than half a day at the A&E department. The medical college then worked out the mortality rates linked to the long waits, which had frequently made the headlines in the country last year. Addressing the issue at the NHS Recovery Forum last month, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said the long waits at the accident and emergency departments are among the issues that are forefront on everyone's mind. In the recent industrial action by the health workers, especially the ambulance staff, many hospitals reported deaths linked to long waiting hours. In the West Midlands region alone, a total of 37 people died after lengthy ambulance waiting times in the first 9 months of 2022, compared to only one patient denying in 2020, which saw hundreds of fatalities due to the COVID-19 pandemic. According to information provided to the BBC by the West Midlands Ambulance Service, the longest time an ambulance had to wait to hand over a patient to a hospital was 21 hours. Various hospitals in the region also recorded waiting times of up to 15 and 19 hours. Once an ambulance arrives at hospital, the patient then waits to be taken out of the vehicle, depending on availability of the staff and beds in hospital. Sharon Graham, the Secretary General of Unite, one of the largest trade unions, said their voices are not being heard and charged the government with criminal negligence. The union said the government had months to intervene to end the dispute and prevent the strike.
You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
This one lay.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Rapprochement seems to be the word of the day for many Arab countries regarding Syria. Now, this after many of them cut off ties with Syria back in 2013 and 2014. Now that it is obvious that the Syrian government isn't going anywhere, relations are starting to be rekindled from Oman to Egypt to Saudi Arabia and others. And now Saudi Arabia is inviting Syria to rejoin the Arab League and to attend the next meeting, which will be held in Saudi Arabia itself. What does it all mean and why now? Stay with us on this Spotlight to find out. I'd like to welcome my guest now to the program. Peter Ford, a former British ambassador to Syria out of Manchester. And Isha Krishnaswamy, podcaster and journalist out of St. Petersburg.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me on this Spotlight. Let's start it off in Manchester. And Peter, your evaluation of the role Russia is playing to try to mend fences between Damascus and Riyadh. Let's start from there.
Yeah, Russia has played an extremely important role as a kind of marriage broker, an intermediary at what used to be a difficult moment in Saudi-Syrian relations, given that Saudi Arabia had been supporting the armed opposition. This is what Russia does so well, serious diplomacy. In fact, they're giving the Americans a master class in how to conduct Middle East diplomacy. And this summit with Assad, probably invited, is going to crown their achievements.
Isha, why do you think this rapprochement is taking place at this time by these Arab countries?
Well, obviously, one of the biggest signs is the declining U.S. influence in the region, because back in 2013, when all these countries broke off ties, they were very confident that the opposition side would win this war. And on top of that, they also did not want to isolate or alienate the U.S. By disobeying them. And so what this shows is obviously the fact that the Syrian Arab Army has been very successful in the past 8 to 9 years in pushing the opposition's territorial gains to a very small area. And number two is, of course, the West's waning influence in the Middle East. Just a month ago, there was China brokered a deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And as Iran and Syria have been allies for a really long time, it's a natural progression that Syria will be welcomed back into the fold.
Well, Peter, in general, what does it mean for Syria When it was constantly told, I mean, from 2013 on, how many times we heard Assad must go, that government must be overthrown. And now, years later, the Syrian government is intact. So many of those Western governments that said that, the heads have been changed. And what does it mean now for the Syrians when these Arab countries are coming back and trying to reestablish diplomatic ties?
It's kind of symbolically important more than militarily important. It's been a long time now that the Arab, or most of the Gulf countries, stopped giving active support to the armed opposition in Syria. So it's not this new rapprochement is not going to change what was already an improved situation on the ground, but it's very important politically. It demonstrates that Syria has survived, that Syria is going from strength to strength regionally, and I think above all, it puts pressure on the United States, which is going to interpret this as a slap in the face, and indeed that is what it is. Let us not make any mistake. This is a big setback for U.S. Regional diplomacy and a calculated one on the part of Saudi Arabia, a lesson to the Americans, and will put them under pressure to withdraw their forces from Syria, which is the biggest obstacle to Syria's recovery, because the Americans control the area that has Syria's oil and grain.
Okay, we're going to get on to that again a little bit later. But in general, Isha, I want to look at, Peter talked about this being a slap in the face to the Americans. I want to look at that, expand on that a little bit more, because now with Saudi Arabia actually reestablishing or trying to reestablish ties and inviting Syria to rejoin the Arab League, what is the difference now as opposed to years ago? Saudi Arabia would not have dared to go against its Washington masters, but tell me your take on what is going on.
About a year ago, China and Saudi Arabia had a long discussion and kind of got into an agreement where there was some military security issues. And so, of course, this means that Saudi Arabia feels less threatened, more confident in opposing the U.S. On top of it, the opposition has failed, so they don't have to worry about the wrath of the opposition, who naturally are members of Al-Qaeda, ISIS, etc., coming back home and feeling that wrath. So I think those are the two things. On top of this, I read a Council for Foreign Relations report where President Biden last year basically wanted MBS to increase the oil production to bring down the oil. And they literally said that Saudi Arabia's traditional role is to basically pump when we ask them and to not pump when we ask them. And I think for Saudi Arabia, they realized that just being the pumper of oil for Washington is not a long-term viable strategy. So I think these things combined, and also just looking at the weakening of the U.S. influence in this region, has made them think about their priorities and think about their longer-term survival. Hmm. And that's why this is going on, in my opinion.
Well, Peter, your take, how do you think this is going to affect Riyadh-Washington relations now that Riyadh is making these type of moves that they are?
Well, I think turn in Saudi strategy occurred really about 3 years ago. At the time of there was a tanker war going on in the Gulf, and it was all part of the American economic war on Iran, and America's stepped up efforts at that time to stop Iranian tankers taking oil through the Gulf. And about that time, there was an attack on a Saudi oil refinery by a drone attack. Many observers attributed that to Iran, but it wasn't clear. Anyway, Saudi Arabia, I believe, drew the conclusion at that moment that it could not rely on American protection. And what was striking was that when it happened, the U.S. Ships that were in the area withdrew so that they would be out of range of drone attack. That, I think, underlined to the Saudis that they were on their own and that they were more likely to be dragged into America's wars than have America defend Saudi Arabia. And what we've seen over the last 3 years has been the gradual elaboration of this tendency. Saudi realism, they realize that they have to get along with Iran. We saw the recent meeting of the two, and now this new step goes further to cement the new relationship.
Well, Isha, Russia also wants to help Syria and Turkey reestablish relations. Let's talk about that side of things. How likely do you see this happening? And especially that, you know, Turkey is still occupying Syrian territory. Your assessment of that?
Well, there's two things. Yes, Turkey is still occupying Syrian territory, and they're also funding a lot of the opposition in that territory, too. So I think for Syria to for there to be a realistic rapprochement, Turkey definitely needs to pull back from the occupied territory. And worst of all, in the territories that have Turkey-friendly troops occupying it, basically that's where one-third of Syria's grain grows and a large portion of Syria's oil. And basically Syria is not getting the hard currency from that area. And that is a big problem for Syria. And Washington's strategy about in 2019, the Deputy Defense Secretary basically mentioned the strategy of how they wanted to occupy this area as a way of like starving Syria out so that people would not want the Syrian Arab Army and the current government there. And so as long as Turkey is aiding and abetting that, it's going to be hard. But I also think that Turkey understands what's going on because a few months ago, there was a terrorist attack in Turkey. And the Turkish foreign minister refused to accept Washington's condolences because obviously it seems like they have intelligence as to who is really behind it. So I think there are two things. Turkey understands its precarious position and the fact that Russia is a neighbor and there's the big Black Sea area that and it's like geostrategic position there. So, but on the other hand, Turkey is definitely occupying, was a large player in this war. So I feel like, again, Turkey is probably thinking about the long-term interests and what suits their business interests and what suits their military interests. Mm-hmm. And so I think they're more open to negotiation now than they ever were before.
Okay. Peter, I want to pose that same question. I want to hear your take on the Turkey-Syria aspect of it. And also, can Syria really return to normal when they have such vast amounts of land still being occupied, when the United States, American troops are there, when the Americans are stealing their oil? I'd like to hear your perspective on both.
Erdogan is under a lot of domestic pressure to fix the Syrian file. Turkey has been hosting over 1 million Syrian refugees, and most Turks want them returned to Syria. That's not going to happen while Turkey has bad relations with Syria and is effectively occupying part of Syria. It was always inevitable that sooner or later Turkey would withdraw from northwest Syria. They're not defending any Turkish-speaking minority. They have no claims on territory in Syria. Their efforts to change the government in Syria are obviously not going to succeed. So it was inevitable that sooner or later they were going to draw the conclusion that they should withdraw. But the problem is how to withdraw gracefully. And this, I think, is where Russian diplomacy is key. They've advanced very, very gradually, quietly, a lot of work behind the scenes. But it does look now, with this quadripartite meeting on the horizon, that the end is in sight. And at some point in the next 12 months, the Turkish forces will withdraw, probably leaving a situation, a rather messy situation, similar to that you have in southern Syria, where, again, Russia brokered a peace that left some of the armed militias still keeping some of their weapons, but effectively working with the government. It's going to be very messy, especially in Idlib. There are going to be a lot of security problems. Mm-hmm. Syria will be keen to reestablish its sovereignty over the northwest, and then again that will put pressure on the Americans to remove their last piece on the chessboard in Syria and allow Syria to get back control of its oil. And this question is absolutely key to Syria's economic and therefore political recovery. The top priority is to get back control of those oil and grain-rich provinces. Mm-hmm. But Syria is used to suffering misery. They have immense resilience.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, well, Isha, what about the Israeli role in all of this in trying to create chaos in Syria? I mean, we've just witnessed a few more attacks on Syrian soil. Tell me about that side of things.
Well, there are two things. Of course, Israel sees Iran and also Hezbollah as a big existential threat. And they identify, unfortunately, Syria as, they think Syria is a client state of Iran. And so, unfortunately, they see this as a security threat. That's the first thing. The second thing is that the amount of action that the U.S. can actually take in Syria is limited. As we learned last week, there was a drone strike that actually did hit a U.S. airbase. So Israel is basically acting as U.S.'s long arm in the region in order to continue the U.S. interests. And the U.S. strategy is definitely based on the continued presence of the moderate rebels and also the ability for the occupied territories to take away Syria's oil and Syria's grain and other things. So Israel has been doing that. And of course, there's the issue of Golan Heights, which Israel took from Syria. And recently, Syria asserted that it wanted it back. So I think these three issues have kind of culminated in the most recent attack on Homs.
Well, Peter, is all of this what we're seeing just indicative of the end of the U.S. rules-based international order?
Permit me a hollow laugh about that phrase, rules-based. Yeah, the rules that they make, mm-hmm. but not internationally approved rules, not the UN Charter, not the ICC, the International Criminal Court, to which America is not a party, although they try to make use of it against Russia. I think the rest of the world it just laughs when America and Europe uses this phrase, respect for the rules-based order. That means their order,
right.
Them ordering the rest of the world around. if I may, just to go back to these Israeli attacks, which are, of course, blatant contraventions of international law and any kind of rules-based order, I think we can interpret them as a sign of failure. The Israelis say they're carrying out these attacks to stop Iran becoming more entrenched in Syria. Well, if they're having to increase so much the number of these attacks, there have been 9 so far this year, I believe, doesn't that prove that the strategy is failing and that Iran is, if anything, ever more deeply entrenched in Syria? And why? Precisely to help Syria defend itself against Israel.
Isha, your overall perspective, the future of Syria, what do you think it will take to get Syria up and running again, a more sense of normalcy again?
The very first thing is weakening the sanctions regime. The sanctions that the U.S. put Syria under is completely draconian. And the problem is that even when something is not covered under sanctions, companies are afraid of getting the wrath of the U.S. and European community that they just won't sell. So Syria has trouble getting medical equipment. Syria has trouble getting ambulances. These basic things, they have trouble with construction and equipment. So definitely weakening and eliminating or finding a workaround the U.S. sanctions, which are extensive. And even after the recent earthquake, they weren't. The U.S. refused to change it or lower it, even though they claimed they did. They didn't actually end up doing it. So that is the first thing. The second thing is, of course, getting rid of the area in the northeast that's been occupied by Rojava and also other moderate rebels, because that is such a resource-rich area for Syria, and they need all the hard currency they can get in order to trade and get new equipment for reconstruction. Those are the main two things. And of course, having diplomatic relations restored with other Arab countries is going to help the trade part. And it's going to be a long road, and it's a very difficult road as long as the U.S. and U.K. and NATO keep their current position on Syria.
Okay. And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me on this spotlight. Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria out of Manchester. Isha Krishnaswamy, podcaster and journalist out of St. Petersburg. And viewers, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.